Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, Black business owners helping each other out in the pandemic, and the challenges the Southern Sierra Miwok Nation faces as it continues its petition for federal recognition. But first, let's turn to Fresno's iconic Tower District, where if you've been paying attention to the news, you know there's been plenty of pushback to a church trying to buy the 1939 Art Deco Tower Theater. As one business owner told us, zoning would have to change for a church to operate.
If they have to rezone, there won't be any new businesses with liquor license allowed down here. So what that does is it stunts the growth of the area.
Adventure Church declined to talk with us. Meanwhile, both the theater's neighbors, Sequoia Brewing Company and the Painted Table, are taking legal action, pursuing their right of first refusal to purchase the building. But while all of this is going on, other businesses in the district have adapted to all kinds of other challenges during the pandemic. And as FM89's Sarith Hawk reports, the last year has transformed this tight-knit neighborhood into a place ready for change and new tenants.
Along Fern Avenue in the Tower District, businesses are boarded up, some lined with graffiti. There's trash piled in the doorways. But on this sunny Saturday afternoon, volunteers move brooms along the sidewalk and sweep the debris into boxes. And there's an upbeat feeling about their work. One of the cleaning crew is Casey Austin. She grew up in the tower and is now leasing the former Bank of America building on this street. It's still empty, but she plans on opening a marijuana dispensary called Cookies Fresno.
It would revitalize that whole strip as new lighting, 24-hour security, which would then enhance the businesses around it.
She's holding the space while the city considers her application. Last year, Fresno began accepting applications for recreational dispensaries, and companies have been quick to file. Austin says she knew immediately that the location would be perfect for a dispensary.
That is an area that has been sitting empty, and if you go by it, it is created, as a result of sitting empty, it has created blight. And there's very few things that can go in an old bank building.
Let's see if we can walk up the side.
Tyler Mackey, executive director of the Tower District Marketing Committee, agrees. He points to a string of other locations within sight of each other where dispensaries are applying for a space.
Here we can see Bank of America, Chicken Pot Pie Shop, and the old Starbucks. There's not 1,000 feet between each of them, so literally only one of them can get it because it's a direct line.
The marketing committee has endorsed Cookies and another dispensary called the Artist Tree, bidding for a location in the nearby Van Ness Village.
If we can get that area with some real traffic, and that's kind of what we think the dispensaries will bring, is a large amount of traffic.
As he walks along Olive Avenue, Mackey says business owners have been resourceful about staying open during the pandemic. Parklets have popped up in front of businesses, made possible with city grants over the summer.
People are going to have more space to come and enjoy places like Fab because COVID has forced us to make some changes, but we're not going to give those advancements back.
And some businesses are finding other ways to expand outdoors, like the LGBTQ nightclub Fab. He points to an extensive back patio.
So that fencing area over there basically doubled the size of their business. So they actually now have a large patio that takes up pretty much the same square footage as their original interior space.
And Mackey says two more nightclubs are waiting to open on the same street. But it's not just weed shops and lounges in the tower. Just a few buildings down on Olive, construction is going on at the upcoming Bonsai Japanese Bar and Kitchen. David Rossavong has been a longtime business owner in the Tower District.
I was the operator for the Ivy Room on the other side of Tower. My wife was a bartender here at Scores in Laughing Buddha. She actually paid for her nursing school just bartending here. So
that's about 8 years of history here in the Tower. He says he was already planning to open this new space when the pandemic hit.
The great thing about Tower is you can be as creative as you want to be as a business here, and it's so accepting and people love it here.
But many in the community have found it hard to accept what's happening with the Tower Theater. It's been in escrow for months with Adventure Church. The issue has brought an outpouring of responses. Business owners and residents have flooded City Hall with emails and phone calls, and weekly Sunday protests have drawn even more attention.
The Tower Theater is like our icon here, and that would take that completely away from us.
That's Irene Saul, owner of Irene's Cafe. In between lunch and dinner service, she takes a break on the restaurant patio. Just last month, she reopened the patio for outdoor dining when restrictions were lifted.
This last shutdown was really drastic for us. It was devastating.
But she's been determined. Saul cut back her staff of 25 to just 4 people, including herself and her son. They've kept their entire menu and service hours. This year will be her 30th year in business. Tyler Mackey says this kind of stamina is a defining characteristic of the district, especially since the pandemic.
The people of the Tower District are resilient. They know what they want. They're here for the long haul. They're fully committed. And they took their licks. But they plan to brush it off and come back strong.
Mackey says just under the surface, there's a far more lively Tower District ready for business once restrictions are fully lifted. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Restrictions on businesses designed to slow the spread of COVID-19 have been devastating for some entrepreneurs. But some Black-owned business owners say the power of community has helped them to adapt and even thrive in these uncertain times. To learn more, I spoke to Nick Hill, President and CEO of the Kern County Black Chamber of Commerce, Dee Slade, President of the African American Network of Kern County, Arthur Moye, CEO of Full Circle Brewery in Fresno, and Chanel Wapner, owner of Just My Essentials in Old Town Clovis. Her storefront was broken into and vandalized in September as part of a hate crime. She started the conversation by sharing what has happened to her business since the attack.
The community of Old Town Clovis has wrapped themselves around us to the point where if I decided to close, you know, I would be letting them down. So not only have we reopened and remodeled, we had a lot of just wonderful people that volunteered services and materials. I had PPG donated the paint and a painter, Custom Cal Tile, you know, donated the tile and the labor. I had local people that were, whatever their experience and expertise was, help out with, you know, decorating and repainting the furniture that was marked up and the cleanup, and it was just wonderful. And so from all the help that I received from the community, we were actually able to really build our business, build our brand, and actually open up a second location.
And you were able to do that in the midst of a pandemic, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that was, you know, it just goes to show there's so much good. There's more good. There's more support. There's so much support down here. And it's really amazing because being a Black-owned business in Old Town Clovis, it just really surprised me. And it just, the second reason for opening up a location really was behind that. I wanted to help other Black-owned and then women-owned businesses come to Clovis and show them by the ways of my growth and Clovis wrapping themselves around me, that they can bring their business here and survive as well. This is a phenomenal place. I really love Clovis.
It's so good to hear good news. Arthur, you're the CEO of Full Circle Brewery, which is a business that has, from what I understand, really had to pivot over the course of the pandemic. Can you talk about what your experience has been and where things stand today?
We were required to pivot for sure. A big part of our brand was entertainment, live entertainment, selling beer right to the consumer, which is the highest margin that you can sell beer at. And then obviously during the pandemic, it was actually on my birthday, March 17th, St. Patty's Day, where we had our final event, you know, and it's been almost a year since. We had to pivot to package sales. We were blessed in the fact that we, just before the pandemic, secured a new canning line, and we're working with all these major retailer chain buyers like Save Mart's and Costco's, and that was already building And the fact that we can now produce no revenue from front of house and our entertainment event, we had to pivot and go all in on selling packaged goods. And us having our own canning line gave us the ability to do that. Unfortunately, for a lot of breweries, they didn't have their own canning line, and they had to rely on the mobile canners whose demand was obviously through the roof. So we were able to fill a lot of empty shelves that other breweries without their own packaging equipment couldn't fill. And we've actually found that silver lining, and we've grown in both distribution. You know, we've picked up 4 distributors in the pandemic, and you can find our beer now in Safeways and Save Marts. And part of that pivot required a lot of capital because we had to brew a lot more beer to make the same, you know, bottom line and to pay our bills. So, you know, we, you know, tapped into the community and did a crowd equity funding campaign through startengine.com, and we were able to raise funds to add more tanks and more production capacity to help us complete that pivot.
Arthur, you were talking about capital, and we know, of course, that access to capital is a struggle that is often cited by business owners, and particularly Black entrepreneurs. Dee Slade, you're the president of the African American Network of Kern County. You work with Black and minority entrepreneurs. Can you speak to this struggle to access capital?
Many of the challenges that our organization has researched and have current information, some of the minority businesses, Black and Latino, they are not operating as a business in order to apply for the PPP or the Elder or any of the grants that are either coming from the state or from federal government. So what we've been doing, we have been partnering and making absolutely certain that they are vetted, that they have their paperwork in order, and that they can apply for the grants that come from the state. Today, we have a couple of businesses that are doing very well, and they are operating, not at the capacity that they should operate on, but they're still here. So I'm very pleased with some of the progress. There's still a long way to go in making certain that people do qualify for the assistance if they should need it, or to encourage them, as Mr. Hill will speak on, to reinvent themselves and continue to stay in business.
This is Nick Hill with the Kern County Black Chamber of Commerce. And of course, during this pandemic, it hit the African-American community especially hard because, as we all know, that most African-American businesses use their own capital. They don't have venture capitalists backing them. So that means that, like with the on-again, off-again pandemic situation where their business is closed and then their business opens up again, and without the proper dollars to properly advertise their business, you know, a lot of people, a lot of their customers aren't aware, you know, that they're back open. So, you know, that's like a 1-2 punch with the struggle. As far as reinventing their businesses, you know, we ask some businesses to also consider rent sharing. If you're selling 2 different products that would not interfere with the other business, maybe you should consider rent sharing because rent is a big share of their profits. But as far as the Kern County Black Chamber of Commerce is concerned, we had to practice what we preach. So we were able to give out $500 stimulus check to a group of our members, you know, to help them in the middle of this pandemic. We also gave out maybe roughly 90 business memberships because, you know, we would get individual questions and we couldn't answer individual questions. So we made these small businesses a part of our chamber. That way, when we sent out information, we sent information out to everyone. Right now, what we're doing is, like with a lot of the pop-up businesses, we found that a lot of them didn't even have a valid city license. So what we're doing, and actually we have a series of workshops, and we're making sure that they are aware that they have to have their city license, their home occupations permit if they're working out of their home, their fictitious filing, their advertising, a 4-week publication, and their banking information and just basic monthly ledger information, because the city of Bakersfield was giving out $5,000 loans, the B Cares grant. It wasn't a loan, it was a grant. And the only thing they had to do was have their city license, their home occupations permit, and filed the 2018 and 2019 taxes. So we want to make sure that everyone is cooperating with what they have to do. And we're also going to assist. And this is in conjunction with the African American Network of Kern County. During this pandemic, we were also able to do 2 rounds of hiring. for phone banking and things like that for the 2020 census and a few other things. So during the pandemic, where most businesses were struggling, we were surviving, and we were making sure that we spread the wealth between our African-American businesses.
Yeah, it really speaks to the importance of community. And Chanel, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation. Can you talk a bit about what it means to be a woman of color who is running her own business, who has taken this step toward autonomy and independence financially in a way that I think would scare most people, you know, to go out on their own and start their own business? But can you speak about why it was so important to you to do that?
You know, that's a very good question. I've always been the type of person that I don't like being told what to do. So that told me that I needed to be my own boss. But I've also been the type of person that will try anything. And I wake up every day and go, okay, Chanel, your goal is to go out and fail. Because then I learn from that, from failing like that. And all it has done is over the course of time, over my life, is that I've just always been a go-getter. And I always knew that I had to make it work. Starting a business was a no-brainer for me. But I always had a backup plan. So when the pandemic hit, I had already been retired. I retired from corporate America November 23rd, 2009. I just, starting a business, I never saw it as an option. It was, that's just what was going to happen because I wanted to be my own boss. I wanted to do my own thing. I wanted to have, you know, other than the laws of the land, I wanted to be able to do what I wanted to do. And so when this was going, this is, I believe, going into my fourth year at this location, it was chugging along. It was fine. I knew that moving into Clovis, you know, Clovis has its history, but I'm the type of person that I deal with you how you deal with me. And so when I first moved here, everything was great. It was wonderful. The whole time it was wonderful until the pandemic hit. Even when the pandemic hit, my online business picked up. I the reinventing yourself and doing different things, I had to figure out how to make it work because I knew, you know, that I had commitments. I had vendors that I had to pay. I had things that I had to do that I committed to doing. There was no choice for me. So through the pandemic, it slowed down, but I kept every day, you know, like it was a normal day and working through it. When the vandalism happened in September, it was a shock. I mean, I'm 58 years old. I'm from New York City, from the small island with more than 11 million people. I know that racism exists. I was very blessed in my life not to have experienced it directly up until this. And so when this happened, the first thing I thought of when I opened that door and I saw what happened to my store, when I saw all of the racial epithets, you know, spray painted on the wall everywhere, everything was destroyed. And the fear that I felt at that moment, I wanted to pack it up and leave. But as I sat there waiting for my husband and the police to come, it was in that moment that I had to make a decision, is if I'm a quitter, Or what am I going to do? And the people in Clovis that came by when they saw what was going on, you know, it was their support that made me realize who I really am or revalidate who I really am and realize that I can't give up. No matter what it is, God has brought me this far and he has no intentions of dropping me off. So that meant that I had to do my part too. But with everything that's happening and I, you know, and all the blessings that were bestowed on me, I just kept feeling there was still some guilt because there's a lot of other people that things are not going well for them. And I felt like I want to give back. I want to do something. So I'm very fortunate that financially that I didn't need any stimulus. I was just very blessed. And so I didn't need any help from in that direction. I'm very fortunate, you know, just in the plannings of my life. And then so at this point when I'm looking out and reaching, and I've reached out to a lot of the black-owned businesses in Fresno via Facebook and the different groups that I heard about, and I'm like, look, you guys, I'm getting a lot of media coverage. I just walked into the store this morning. I had an envelope that a classroom, it says, Miss Wapner, we are so happy you are open again and that you stayed. And it's Miss Fox's class. It is an envelope full of all these letters and cards from her class. So now I wanted to be able to have that to share that with other people. And I'm like, you guys, bring your business to Clovis. Let me help you. In my second location, I've actually started reaching out to different businesses or different people and saying, hey, look, let's talk about how I can help you. Let's talk about how I can give you a shelf in my store. Let's talk about growth. Let's talk about support. Let's talk about me being able to bless you the way that I've been blessed. And so I think it's really important, especially at this time, that it is. We are great, good, decent people. And we've moved away from being great, good, decent people, and we need to get back there, and I want to do my part in getting back there. I want to help Black-owned businesses, or even business, or even women businesses, in the order of women, Black-owned, and businesses, to help them in my second location with what they're trying to do and what they're trying to achieve. It's not who's right, it's what's right, and that's the right thing to do.
Chanel.
Yes.
This is Nick Hill from the Kern County Black Chamber of Commerce. I'm listening to your situation. I'm listening to your story. It's just so inspiring. It's unfortunate what you went through, you know, but I'm so glad that you have the attitude that you have, because, you know, it takes an entrepreneurial community, you mm-hmm. know, to help other people get through this pandemic that we're in the middle of, you know. And, yeah. and like I said, listening to your story is so inspirational. And the fact that you are so willing to help out other women-owned, minority-owned businesses is truly inspiring. I can't say enough about that.
Is there any way that I can help? I'm here. I'm here. And I just think that there's enough business out there for everybody. But and all of this is somebody that, you know, just like yourself and what you're doing, is extending that hand. It's just amazing. It's amazing to me that if we just come together and figure out how to help everybody, that we can help. We can help. And it's not going to take away anything from you. If anything, it's going to give more to you.
Before we wrap up, I'd just like to give Arthur a chance to weigh in here. I'd imagine there's not a lot of Black men in the craft brewing space, but maybe I'm wrong. But what have your experiences been like?
Yeah, you know, actually, there's only in craft beer, only 1% of all the craft breweries in the U.S. are owned by Black-owned breweries. So, you know, Black man or woman. So the community is small, but it's banded together quite a bit. I would say the biggest piece of support that we did receive was our consumers shifting their consumption from coming to our venue to going to our fullcircletogo.com store. So there was a pretty good shift of people starting to order craft beer online. And during this pandemic, something interesting happened, because it did feel, you know, like we were kind of alone in this, being a Black-owned brewery. Mm. But with the recent events that have transpired and the push to support more social justice, there's been, you know, more breweries, like including ourselves. We didn't put ourselves out as a Black-owned brewery very much until as of late, all these events. And we are now able to be more vocal about that. And the community is supporting and connecting us with more and more Black-owned breweries. So for Black History Month, we've actually reached out, and we've done what's called a collaboration through other breweries. We've kind of banded together and created a bit of community of Black-owned breweries. And that together has invited more of an impact on just the fact that we are here together. And I think that has spurred on an increase in sales, especially since, you know, we can actually deliver and ship all over the state of California. But I think the crowning achievement was the collaboration amongst all those breweries where we released beers. And on those beers, each of the labels from each of the breweries had a representation of civil rights leaders on there. And that beer sold out in, like, you know, less than a couple of hours. So the community is engaged and does realize that, you know, we need to increase diversity in this space.
I mean, it's really remarkable, and it's wonderful to hear. I've been talking with Arthur Moyet, CEO of Full Circle Brewery, Chanel Wapner, owner of Just My Essentials, Dee Glade, president of the African American Network of Kern County, and Nick Hill, president and CEO of Kern County Black Chamber of Commerce. Thank you all so much for being on the show.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Early on in the pandemic, the state of California put an emphasis on equity in its pandemic response, requiring certain levels of testing and outreach in disadvantaged census tracts. Now the vaccine rollout has introduced even more potential for disparities. New state data shows what many have feared, that the vaccine is not being distributed equitably among racial and ethnic groups. Here to walk us through this data is FM89's Carrie Klein as part of this week's COVID-19 update. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you.
So how is the Valley looking this week?
Well, overall, I've got more good news. So new case rates continue to steadily drop.
In our 7-county area, there are now around 800 cases being reported every day, and that's a quarter of what it was a month ago. COVID-related deaths are easing, but slowly. There were still close to 200 deaths reported in the last week. In hospitals, patient loads are steadily falling as well, especially in ICUs, where high capacities had lingered because so many patients are in there long term. When it comes to the state's reopening blueprint, all counties in our area are back in the purple most restrictive tier, except for Mariposa, which is in red. And when it comes to vaccines, you know, the rollout may be slow, but it has been pretty steady. Now, 330,000 doses have gone out in the valley. And although that sounds like a high number, those vaccination numbers per capita are still far lower than the state average.
And I understand that the winter storms around the country have affected our local vaccine supply.
Yes, unfortunately. You know, in Fresno County, nearly 8,000 doses of the Moderna vaccine have been delayed by storms. That's a little less than half its weekly supply. And in Merced County, 2,300 doses were affected, which was 60% of its weekly supply. And there have been reports of this from other counties around the state as well. You know, we're still learning the impacts of this on clinics and appointments for next week. And it's possible that more information came out between when this interview was recorded and when it's being broadcast. And then, you know, when it comes to the potential FEMA-run site in the valley, there is still radio silence from leaders and health officials. Governor Newsom, of course, teased this clinic almost 2 weeks ago, and yet he still has not made an announcement about it. Also, some retail pharmacies are now offering vaccines to those who are eligible. That includes some locations of CVS and Walgreens. You can find info and sign up at those stores through their websites. They are run separately from county health departments.
Now, since we last spoke, the state has published some new vaccine data, specifically the ethnicities and races of those who've received at least one dose. For right now, what does the data show?
Well, it shows what a lot of us could probably have guessed based on what we've been hearing about problems with the vaccine rollout. People of color are far underrepresented among those who have received the vaccine. For instance, Latinos make up about 57% of the valley, but they've received only 26% of vaccine doses. Of course, there are some major data caveats. You know, the way that the state collects racial and ethnic data can be kind of confusing and different from how the Census Bureau does, and so that could be the source of some disparities. Also, in this vaccine data, nearly 20% of people fall into the other category or their ethnicity is unknown. 20% is a lot of people, but even if you were to redistribute all of those numbers, all of those people back into communities of color, they would still be underrepresented in the vaccine data compared to whites. And so I spoke about this with Veronica Garibay. She's the co-executive director of the nonprofit Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability. It works all over the valley and the Inland Empire. And I asked her what these numbers mean to her.
It's heartbreaking and it's maddening in some ways because we should know better. We know the disparate impact of COVID is real. We've seen the data for months, and we've seen how Black and brown families have been hit worst.
But why should we be surprised by these numbers? The vaccine is not actually open to the general public. So why should we expect the vaccine demographics to reflect our community as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important question because yes, healthcare workers were the first to receive the vaccine. And the Kaiser Family Foundation estimates that the entire sector is about 60% white. But even within the healthcare workforce, Tanya Pacheco-Werner believes still not all have the access they deserve. She's the co-director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State. And she's also one of the leads of the Fresno County COVID-19 Equity Project. And she says one group being left behind is providers of in-home support services.
These tend to be people that are, you know, taking care of elders or someone that's severely disabled, and they get money from the state to do this. But a lot of them are monolingual or barely, you know, can functionally speak English.
She and Garibay both say yes. In some ways, the groups that are eligible for the vaccine right now are not entirely representative of our region, but that even within those groups, there have been disparities in vaccine access.
So why would these disparities exist? What's preventing some, particularly people of color, from getting the vaccine?
So there are many reasons that we've talked about in previous COVID updates. You know, one issue you just heard was language barriers, particularly if you think of the elderly. There's also the issue of transportation. A lot of clinics are in urban areas. And for Pacheco Werner, a huge issue is digital literacy, not just disparate access to the internet or a computer, but also just the fact that it's really confusing to know how to sign up, you know, which clinic to go to, which app to use, which website to check.
There's a lot of different processes right now, and I think that as much as possible, in order for us to really feel like we're going to have a handle on what happens when the general population has access to vaccines, we need to address the issue of digital literacy, but more importantly, the coordination that needs to happen across what's happening in counties versus what's happening at the state level.
What's being done to resolve these equity issues?
So one thing that both Pacheco Werner and Garibay talk about is mobile clinics, getting out into rural communities to meet people where they are. Many counties are talking about doing these. Some are further along than others. And Fresno County has already run a number of them, you know, some specifically for farm workers, but also some in smaller communities like Orange Cove and Lanier. And the county is partnering with community organizations that have experience on the ground in those communities, like Garibay's group, the Leadership Council. They're holding a clinic tomorrow in Kentua Creek. It's an unincorporated community in southwestern Fresno County. And they made it happen by first sending flyers to residents, then holding a pop-up event last weekend to share information and register people so that when they run the clinic tomorrow, it should hopefully go quickly and efficiently.
So now there's people who have their vaccine appointment. They know what to bring with them to the appointment so that they don't get turned away, and we'll be there on Saturday for a clinic. And, you know, to a lot of people, they're like, wait, you're going to do it here? Like, you're not going to make me go to Fresno? We're like, no, it's going to happen here. I think that that is incredibly invaluable.
She and Pacheco Werner say teaming up with groups that are trusted in these communities is key. You know, they have connections that can be leveraged and hopefully worked into the public health infrastructure for the next big health disaster.
But are small clinics in rural communities really scalable in a way that will help us vaccinate the entire population?
Well, you're right that mobile clinics like these cannot deliver the thousands of vaccines a day the way a stationary mass vaccination clinic would. But Garibay and Pacheco Werner both said that maybe we as a society need to think differently about what it means for a vaccination effort to be high impact, that the quantity of vaccines will be lower in one of these mobile clinics, but maybe the fact that they're being delivered to small communities that have been hit hard by the virus can also be high impact.
Carrie, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Yosemite and the Sierra Nevada foothills are home to the Southern Sierra Miwok Nation, but the tribe has been enmeshed in a decades-long battle for recognition by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. To learn more about the current status of that fight and how it's been shaped by COVID-19, I spoke with Clay Mouin River, managing director of the Mwumati Family Healing Center. They started by discussing why the Miwok Nation has yet to be recognized.
The Miwok, they have been in the fight for over 40 years. And what that looks like is working with attorneys and anthropologists and archaeologists to piece together the history, the narrative, and physical documentation, which also involves tribal enrollment processes, to demonstrate that the Miwok have always existed in the Yosemite region in Mariposa County region of California. Historically, there's the assumption that they were removed during the gold rush and were killed, or that other tribes who have been acknowledged historically are the only ones that still exist in this space here. And so part of this process is presenting to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They have an Office of Federal Acknowledgement, and they have review boards that review these documents of how many members are enrolled, and then also how often those enrolled members are participating in cultural activities to be defined as a contemporary culture. So the reason why the Miwok have struggled in the past to be acknowledged as a tribe is the findings from the Bureau of Indian Affairs as to why they've denied the acknowledgement is that from 1982 to 2011, they haven't had enough acting participatory members to prove that they're a contemporary society, which is offensive to the tribe because they have been acknowledged by the park, the national park systems, the state and local governments, because they've been involved with them for years. And there's no question that the Miwok were a tribe up until 1982. So currently they're working to document all the ceremonies and gatherings and powwows and ask people to sign in spaces you wouldn't normally, because of spiritual reasons, ask someone to sign in. And so it's sort of a really intense process. It can be triggering and re-traumatizing for tribal members to be asked to do something that other races and other people are not asked to do.
So I understand that there are some crucial deadlines that are coming up in terms of making your case for federal recognition. Is that right?
Yeah. So May 17th is when the Miwok's attorney, which is based out of the firm Dean Hobbs and Strauss, and they're national, and they, one of their branches is in Sacramento, and they specialize in tribal rights. And so we have a strong team representing the tribe, and they are working closely with the tribal council to gather all the information to present again. So the last couple of years has been gathering surveys, almost like a community needs assessment, but a survey of tribal members so we can go back and ask questions from elders or people that have been present from 1982 to 2011 if they attended graduations and funerals and memorials and ceremonies and how often, to then sort of fill this narrative and this gap of them still existing and still being here. And so it's a lot of paperwork, and it takes a lot of trust in this system. And of course, a lot of us know that people of color do not have trust in systems. They were not built for us to succeed. In fact, they were built for us to be imprisoned and for, in some forms, modern day slavery. So it's hard to approach elders and say, can you fill out this survey so we can prove to the government that we exist? So it's not an easy process on our end. It seems like it would be easy to gather up 200, 400 surveys, but it involves really explaining to individual tribal members who are very traditional, the reasoning behind it and why we have to do kind of the dirty work to get to the end goal, and what actually being federally recognized would mean, having access to the services that other people are entitled to and having equity and equality in those systems.
To what extent has the pandemic factored into the work that you're doing?
We have had to shift to technology, which has not anything that the tribe is really interested in fully being on board with. It feels like a form of assimilation. Spiritually, culturally, we have so much tied to the land, and there's a generation, multiple generations in tribal communities that do not see technology as a good thing. And some of us do. We see that it has the benefit to support us in some aspects, but in other aspects removes us from the spiritual ties to the land. But the biggest thing is that we are in a rural area where internet connection, phone connection is challenging to begin with. But because of the economic status of the tribal members, they don't have running water or electricity or internet. It's not a priority. Their basic needs aren't even met. And so I would say more than half of the tribe actually don't even have the ability to stay connected in the ways that we need to. And it's been really detrimental because it's not safe to gather in the ways that we normally would be practicing our culture and practicing community. We're very intergenerational. And so we don't like having siloed meetings where just like one generation of people are making decisions for a whole group, a whole tribe. But having young youth all the way to elders being able to all have a voice is not happening right now. And that's fairly detrimental spiritually and politically and all the aspects of our cultural ways. So the pandemic is like really challenging us of like, how can we build resiliency and move forward, and what would our ancestors have done, and really reflecting on like what we would have to change to be a contemporary tribal community. What do we want to keep? Who gets to make those decisions about what we keep and what we let go of in order to move forward in a good way?
And then all this work takes money as well. How has fundraising been given the fact that people can't really gather in the way that they used to?
Yeah, that's been the hardest thing, because in tribal community, it's hard to explain to funders that we didn't have a financial loss. More what we really lost was our volunteers that ran everything. When you don't have the ability to have people safely show up to do food service or help run programming, tribal communities so really rely on their natural helpers and different levels of generations showing up to give their time to be part of the community and the culture. And so in ways that other, like, not culturally specific nonprofits or agencies might have funding to support those programs, our programs have been run by their own people. And so the financial impact is hard to explain, but the fundraising effort is challenging in the fact that we are always sort of competing with Yosemite. And the attention, as soon as that name is mentioned, the attention goes to the national park. And people are more interested in supporting what might be happening there. And they also don't want to have to be responsible for any damages that they may have, like, unknowingly contributed to the oppression of the tribes there. Millions of people come on to the Southern Sierra Miwok homelands without even knowing whose homelands they're on, and contributing to that erasure and acknowledgement of them being here. The biggest fees right now, which go into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, is to pay the attorneys and the anthropologists and the archaeologists for their time and efforts, and the fees that are associated with acquiring documents within other entities and agencies, and submission fees. And so we're spending more money than is coming in. And that is because there is no way to, that we have found yet, to really bring the attention to the Miwok in a good way.
Well, Clay River, we so appreciate you taking the time to share a bit of that history with us today. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The 4th Fresno State Art Song Festival is coming up on February 26 and 27. This year's virtual event provides a performance, collaboration, competition, and presentation platform for composers, poets, and singers of the Central Valley and around the world. Valley Public Radio's David Aus spoke with Festival Director, Fresno State Professor Maria Briggs, and Fresno State Professors Bryn Saito and Kenneth Froelich.
Dr. Maria Briggs, welcome. So great to have you with us today.
Hello, David. Thank you for having me.
What exactly is an art song, and what distinguishes it from other forms of music?
Well, the term art song is really only used in classical vocal music. In time of Schubert, they were just songs that he wrote, but now they're art songs. So it's a song set to poetry by a composer using classical Western tradition usually, but that's kind of the narrow definition. There's all kinds of exceptions and what have you. For me, the main difference between an art song and, let's say, an opera aria is that an opera aria comes from a bigger story. The beauty of an art song that it's a self-contained universe. It's that one poem that tells some kind of story or expresses an idea, and it's self-contained. So there are these beautiful, intimate miniatures, not like arias, which is on a big scale. They're miniature pieces, and so there's so much subtlety and detail and context that you can give them. And especially if you work with a beautiful pianist that you know well and you rehearse together a lot and you discuss things, you can together bring to life these compositions and make very special experiences for yourselves and for the audience.
So we have a variety of elements here. There's the musical composition, which is the melody for the song and its accompaniment. There's the lyrical content, which is the poem from the poet. And it must be brought to life by a singer, a vocalist. So talk to us about how these three different disciplines come together in the Art Song Festival at Fresno State.
As far as I'm aware, we are really the only festival that looks at all these three areas and gives a meaningful platform to young poets, young composers, and young performers to come together and create new works, as well as experience the classical canon of art song as well. And the way we do it is that really the festival runs all year. It starts with the poetry competition. And from the poetry competition, when we select the winner, that poem is then used for the composition competition. And so our composers receive their packet and they have that poem that they all set their music to. Once we pick finalists for the composition competition, I then select some singers who perform these at the finals. And so when you come to the festival at the poetry and composition finals, you get to hear it all. You get to hear the reading of the finalist poems. Then you hear the finalist compositions performed by our singers. And you get the prizes. You hear the announcement of the prizes, but also we have audience prizes. So as audience, you get to vote for your favorite composition as well.
Kenneth Froelich is professor of music composition at Fresno State, and we spoke to him to get the perspective of a composer in art song. Ken, were you involved in helping to pick the poems that ended up as finalists, and what kind of criteria do you use for that in this specific concept of art song?
I was one of several faculty and individuals who were involved with the process of selecting the poem, and one of the things that we were looking at was not only, you know, whether the poem was, you know, going to be a beautiful poem that would work well, but also that it would set well to music. Not every poem is going to necessarily set well to music. They can be really wonderful poems, but what we're looking for is a poem which is going to, first of all, say a lot, but not necessarily in a lot of words, because you need to have time to be able to sing the words that are present. And then also find a poem that's really going to be elevated through the process of song.
What's your advice to composers, especially student composers, in crafting this kind of musical composition that elevates the lyric?
So much of the craft of composition right now, when you're a student, is learning how to be creative with your voice. And that does mean sometimes you are focusing on other areas of music beyond just the melody. But when you're writing for song, you really have to be focused on that melodic component and figuring out ways to make sure that whatever you're writing is going to, again, fit the words. And so that's the first thing you have to look at, is what music is going to fit those words and really set the words properly, set the speech patterns correctly, the vowel settings correctly, so that way accents line up with the meter. These are all really important factors that you don't necessarily have to consider if you're writing for instruments. So there's many factors that go into creating a good song, and it can be a real challenge.
Another Fresno State professor involved in the festival is Bryn Saito, assistant professor of English and creative writing in the English department. She's a noted published poet and worked with the poets who submitted poems for the festival. I talked with her about the intersection of music and poetry.
Poetry is quite musical, and I like to always remind my students that the origins of poetry are in song, and cultures saying their songs to each other, saying their stories to each other in song is a way for their stories to continue through the generations. And as poets, we often think about the musicality of our words, the rhythm of our words, the pacing, the energy, the consonants and assonance, and the way the words rhyme internally or with their end rhymes. So oftentimes my students will talk about their poems as scores, as sheet music to be recited aloud one day. So this is a great opportunity for our student poets to actually have their poems sung and accompanied with music and turned into songs at this art song festival.
An important feature of the festival will be a stunning array of guest artists doing master's classes and other kinds of teaching. Let's talk a little bit about your guest artists.
Honestly, this is such a silver lining to this whole studying during COVID, there are opportunities, windows of opportunity that are open right now that probably won't exist when this is over, and we need to take advantage. I was thinking, who is the biggest name in the world in the art song business right now? Who is the most iconic art song singer that we can invite? And I thought of Gerald Finley. He is as big as it gets in opera and in art song, especially in his voice type, bass baritone. I've always loved his work. I've actually met him when I worked at Glyndebourne. I was in a Don Giovanni production, and he was in the Meistersingers singing the lead role there. And it was just phenomenal, and I've always admired his work. So I decided, you know, what the worst thing that can happen is he'll say no. And I approached his agent, and they were interested. So long story short, we have Gerald Finley, and it's just amazing, an amazing opportunity. He's going to give 2 masterclasses. We have other guests who are also just fantastic, fantastic artists. Kurt Erickson, composer from the Bay Area, also very recognized nationally here, just won an art song competition with National Association of Teachers of Singing with his song cycle called Hear Bullet. We have Anke Höppner, a dramatic soprano, joining us from Sydney. Beautiful singer and a very distinguished pedagogue. And we also have Dr. Julian Nielsen from the Bay Area, one of the most distinguished voice teachers here in the States. Her students sing all over the country. I'm actually really excited and just stunned about this lineup. Also on Saturday, which is the second day, we are going to have a vocal competition. When the students sing in masterclasses, then some of them get selected for the competition, and they all sing on Saturday. And again, the audience are invited to vote for their favorite singer. So that will be very exciting. It's always such an electric event, and I hope people can join and get behind their favorite singer and vote.
The 4th Fresno State Art Song Festival will be on February 26th and 27th. To learn more and register, look for concerts on the Fresno State Music Department homepage or look for the Art Song Festival page on Facebook.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.